You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
10 koutou katoa, ko kia te tōku ingoa. No mā haere mai ki Te Wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for our party Thursday. My name is Caster and I'll be your host for today, filling in for Caden. I'll be with you for the next hour and joined in the studio by producer Pranuja. Ifakane, coming up on the show, for City Counselling this week, Wire host Caden spoke to Councillor Julie Ferry on Mayor Wayne Brown's controversial comment towards an RNZ staff member, the latest statistics on illegal dumping in Auckland, and alternative names for the City Rail Link. And I spoke to Executive Director of the New Zealand Drug Foundation, Sarah Helm, about a new bill that would remove the possibility of prosecution for those looking for medical support after an overdose. Pranuja, what have you got for us today?
For our weekly catch-up with the Labour Party, I spoke with Shannon Halbert about proposed changes to Te Tiriti, the New Zealand-India Free Trade Agreement, and rising anti-Indian sentiment in New Zealand. I spoke with World Vision New Zealand National Director T.J. Grant about the first reading of the Modern Slavery Bill, and I spoke with World Vision... And I spoke with... And I spoke with Dr. Peter Willis on the University of Auckland's breakthrough study on evolution.
He aha or whakaro, we would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so get in touch. Tuku pātohi mai, text in on 5395, or wae mai rānei, give us a call in studio on 309-3879. Kawa e wareware e ahena koutou te whakarongo ki ēnei kōrero anō. Hei pakehere rokiroki mārunga i te pai, tukutuku o irirangi poho, me haere ki 95BFM irakati.com. You can catch all of these stories and more as always by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com. Now let's get into the show.
It's time for our weekly catch-up with Labour MP Shannon Halbert.
The government's reviewing Treaty of Waitangi references across 28 pieces of legislation with concerns that stronger obligations could be reduced to simply taking account treaty principles. At the same time, New Zealand has signed a new free trade agreement with India, while incidents of anti-Indian graffiti and political comments around the Indian communities have raised concerns about rising anti-Indian sentiment in Aotearoa. For our weekly catch-up with the Labour Party, I spoke with Shannon Halbert about proposed changes to Te Tiriti, New Zealand Free Trade Agreement, and rising anti-Indian sentiment in New Zealand. So I just wanted to open up with the Treaty of Waitangi. The government has been reviewing Treaty of Waitangi references across 28 pieces of legislation, and reports suggest that some stronger obligations could be changed to lower the threshold of simply taking into account treaty principles. Some critics say this could weaken Maori rights in law and policy. What's Labour's response to these proposed changes?
Our response is that this is the treaty principles bill all over again. We saw the removal... In the Education and Training Act, where a number of schools spoke out against this. We saw it within the vocational reforms from Minister Penny Simmons. And here we are again with the government doing it all over again and not being clear with the public around their intentions here.
The government has framed the review as an attempt to make the treaty references more consistent across legislation. What are your thoughts on this?
Well, their view is making it more consistent is by removing them overall. That is not good practice. That's not the future of our country. By putting in Te Tiriti o Waitangi into legislation, it honours the commitment, the partnership within the areas of government. That's what they have to deliver on. And by removing it, actually they take our country and our nationhood backwards.
The government previously said the Treaty Principles Bill would not go past Select Committee, but critics are now saying these wider changes to treaty references and legislation feel like another way of weakening Te Tiriti's obligations. Do you think the government is going back on that promise in another form?
Well, the government has demonstrated their intention to remove Te Tiriti over and over again. This is just another example, and they'll do it all the different ways that they can. What this is doing, though, is it's eroding the Māori Crown relationship that has, you know, successfully moved forward over the past two decades under consistent governments between National and in Labour. But the reality is that this government under Prime Minister Christopher Luxon, they don't care They've cut funding to Māori initiatives. They've removed the rights of equity across health and education. And here they are, removing Te Tiriti obligations that they should be delivering on and really leading on a global scale.
Moving to the new New Zealand-India Free Trade Agreement, the deal has been framed as a major step in strengthening ties between the two countries, with expected benefits for exporters, education, tourism and business links. How significant is this agreement for New Zealand?
Trade with India is really important for Aotearoa New Zealand, and that's why Labor backed the FTA. It creates real opportunities for exporters, but at the same time, we didn't want to stand in the way of this trade agreement making progress. We did have concerns, of course, about the risk of the underinvestment in India under the deal's terms and whether a future government in India could remove the benefits of the FTA. And so what we've said to businesses that may be partaking in these opportunities, please do your own due diligence. The government has been really keen for political reasons too to get this across the line. We've supported it, but it is important that businesses do their own due diligence here.
How will everyday New Zealanders see benefits from this FTA?
Well, the promises here is that economically we'll see more investment between two countries, but that will benefit New Zealanders and our local economy. We'll see export trade going up, hopefully. As I said, we didn't want to stand in the way of those opportunities. But there are risks here, and I think it's really important that businesses take note that while there are opportunities, due diligence is required. So the opportunities, you know, we should absolutely encourage, but we've just got to walk forward with caution.
Given Labor's support for the FTA, do you think this agreement could change the relationship between New Zealand and India more broadly?
I think we've had a good working relationship with India. This takes us a next step, of course. If I look to the opportunities presented in international education, this does mean that we will see a lift in international enrolments from India, but we can't be naive that is the only channel of opportunity, I guess, that can be created here. So I hope over a number of years that this is just a start, but that relationship will continue to progress. The trade opportunities will be greater, but you know, we need to put one foot in front of the other. And make sure it's working for New Zealand businesses and New Zealanders.
I want to ask about the recent rise of anti-Indian sentiment in New Zealand. New incidents of anti-Indian graffiti have been appearing around Papatoetoe and Royal Oak, alongside Shane Jones's derogatory comment about immigration. What do you make of that broader pattern?
I don't appreciate any politicians, whether it be Shane Jones or the Auckland mayor, making racist comments. I visited the North Shore Sikh Society in the weekend. They raised concerns with me, and I saw on my own social media post the level of racism that has come up because of particular comments from New Zealand's leaders. This is unacceptable. We want to make sure that everyone here in Aotearoa feels like a New Zealander. They are New Zealanders, and we need to support that.
What responsibility do public figures, especially in government, have when speaking about migrant communities, especially during debates around immigration, work and the economy?
Discrimination has no part to play here in Aotearoa New Zealand, and our political leaders, leaders of any kind, you know, should be leading from the front in highlighting the importance of an inclusive New Zealand, one where everyone has a place and culture is valued no matter where you come from. I also find it disgraceful that Prime Minister Christopher Luxon couldn't actually condemn one of his own ministers for their actions. That is poor leadership in my view. That's not what I want to see from a New Zealand government. You know, as I say, I call for inclusion. I think that all cultures, you know, no matter where you come from, should be included, should be valued and should be celebrated as a part of Aotearoa New Zealand.
What do you make of the tension where New Zealand is strengthening economic ties with India while Indian communities here are facing really inflammatory rhetoric?
I think that's one of the risks involved. And that's also why I think political leadership is so important, because we need to take care of the cultures that we have in New Zealand, and that impacts too on the trade commitments offshore. So we have to do that authentically, with integrity, and with values in place, and that's not what I've seen from the government recently, and I encourage them to do better.
What would Labor want to see from the government in response beyond just condemning individual incidents after they happen?
In the discussions we've had, there is an important pathway forward, which is about social cohesion. When I look at Tāmaki Makaurau, Auckland, we know there is a lot of work to do around bringing different ethnic communities together through education, and in my view is incredibly important through our schools, that we start to build an inclusive society. And, you know, where I come from, whether it be around Te Tiriti and Māori issues, whether it be about the inclusion of our rainbow communities, or whether it be about representing our Indian whānau and ethnic communities, we have a significant role to build social cohesion here in Aotearoa.
That was Shannon Halbert about proposed changes to Te Tiriti, the New Zealand-India Free Trade Agreement, and rising anti-Indian sentiment in New Zealand.
That was our weekly chat with Labour MP Shannon Halbert.
Now, tell me about your father.
City Counselling on 95BFM, our weekly chat with the good people of Auckland Council.
Auckland Mayor Wayne Brown is facing backlash for referring to an RNZ staffer of Indian descent as a Muslim terrorist. Leaders in the Indian community have expressed concern about how this fits into a recent rise in anti-Indian rhetoric. In the last financial year, Auckland Council received 24,000 reports of illegal dumping. And broadcaster John Bridges has suggested that this upcoming city rail link be given a better name than simply CRL. One of the top suggestions includes CARL, or the City of Auckland Rail Link. For City Counselling this week, Thursday Wire host Caden asked Councillor Julie Ferry about all of these topics. They began by asking what Julie Ferry's reaction was to Mayor Wayne Brown's comments towards an RNZ staff member.
I think the first thing to note is that they were unacceptable, and that it's frustrating because I think we're all trying to create an inclusive society that is tolerant and friendly and welcoming, and when stuff like this happens, the mayor always says we need to stop doing dumb stuff. This was dumb stuff, and I'm baffled as to why he said it in the first place. It was completely unnecessary and, unacceptable.
This also comes after Shane Jones' butter chicken tsunami comment. Are you concerned about bigotry directed towards Indian members of our communities?
Yes, absolutely. And that's part of the thing with this comment, right, is it doesn't come in a context of isolation. It comes in a context where nationally and internationally we are dealing with a lot of racism and frankly hate and bigotry, and it contributes to that. And while he, I think, did not intend to contribute to that, I can say that knowing the guy reasonably well, I don't imagine that was on his mind, it did, and that can't be unwound. The thing that I find really awful about all of this too is that while, the mayor has apologised, he apologised privately before it was public, he then apologised publicly, he is going to take a number of steps in conversation about what those will be, and they will include things like next time he's in Christchurch he will visit one of the mosques where a white supremacist terrorist murdered people. He's meeting the local Muslim community. We're doing stuff with the Ethnic Communities Advisory Panel as well. The fact that these opportunities for learning have to come out of situations of unnecessary harm. I think with someone like Shane Jones, who I don't know, but what I see is there is a ramping up of this kind of stuff ahead of an election, at a time when the Indian community has already been under pressure. We've had this unacceptable abusive graffiti occurring. you know, a community that already is often targeted. And I remember things from when I was, right through from when I was a kid, a very visible migrant community as well. That stuff is, it's not okay. And I hope that what we're seeing with some of these comments from the likes of Shane Jones, which is clearly quite a premeditated comment, is what's called an extinction blast. So this is the final sort of death rattle of this kind of unacceptable racism. I fear that it's not. I hope that it is.
And I want to switch now to ask about the recent numbers around illegal dumping in the Auckland region. Do you see illegal dumping in Auckland as a big issue?
Unfortunately, yes, it is. And it's something I get raised with me reasonably often. One of the problems we have around illegal dumping is that there are some people who are a small number of people who are doing it at scale and as part of their business model. There are other people who are doing it out of sort of almost desperation, or they don't know what to do with some of the big items that are genuinely difficult to dispose of legitimately, particularly if you don't have a trailer or a tow bar or access to storage space, right, where you can store it until you have an inorganic collection. And part of the problem we have is that at the moment a lot of the tools are the same for both types. What we've been doing over time is ramping up things like hotspot inspections. There are mobile cameras that move around hotspots and can actually catch people who then are prosecuted. Quite a reasonable proportion, not enough, but a reasonable proportion of illegal dumping, we actually know who has dumped it, and they are made to go and pick it up, and that does happen. But part of what we need to do is, some of this is the commercial stuff, like, for example, people dumping heaps of tyres in the bush. That stuff needs to be absolutely, you know, prosecuted. But with the other stuff where it's like people genuinely don't know what to do, or they see somewhere where someone put something and they think it's okay to put it there. Some of that's happening too. We actually need to work with neighbourhoods about, okay, it's, you know, these are the legitimate ways to do this. And some of that is also about product stewardship. It's about, okay, when a bed company sells you a mattress, that they will, and perhaps by law, maybe there's a levy or something that goes on the product to help them pay for this, they have to take away the old mattress, those kinds of things. With companies like Ecosa, they usually do that. They deliver it and they take it away, but that's not necessarily widespread. A lot of people are doing these kinds of things secondhand, and that stuff's kind of, you know, invisible in that sort of product stewardship space as well. So there's a whole lot of different things happening there. And in a consumer society where a lot of stuff's disposable, I would love it if part of the conversation about illegal dumping is also, okay, how do we shift our products, the things that people are buying and consuming, to be easier to dispose of, that we think about the end of life when we're creating them and selling them and regulating them as well.
You've answered what was going to be my next question pretty comprehensively already. No, that's okay. But is there anything else you'd like to say on either how much this is costing the council or what you see as potential solutions to this problem?
I think it is expensive. And I think that it would be helpful if we had some more tools from central government, if we were able to set some of those things like fines, if we were able to set those levels ourselves at ways that help with the cost recovery. What would be amazing would be being able to roll out our community recycling centre program faster, because that will mean that people have in their own areas places that they can take stuff to dispose of it when it's that stuff that's quite hard to do. And they'll also have, you know, be able to access networks around them that, you know, can help them to understand, oh, this is what you do with that, and this is what you do with the other thing. So some real support to get that network. I think we've already opened something like 15 across the region, but we've still got a number of areas that don't have anything like that. So we've still got work to do.
And I want to switch now to ask about something which I saw this week and I think is just a bit of fun. Earlier this week, John Bridges published an opinion piece in Stuff suggesting we need a more creative name for the CRL than just the City Rail Link. Is this something you have considered?
I think it's a great idea. I think the reality is that once the City Rail Link is operational, it won't really exist anymore in its own right. It will just become part of a system. And so people won't necessarily say, hey, I'm getting on the CRL, or I quite liked the name Carl. I have a couple of friends called Carl. One of them spells it with a K, though. So shout out to him. He actually used to be on the BFM board years ago. So I don't know if he's still listening. He lives in Dunedin now. But anyway, I did quite like the name Carl. But I think what will happen in reality, all respect to John Bridges, who I am a big fan of his work, and he's a constituent too, is that people will say I'm catching the train. So they won't necessarily say I'm getting on the CRL, because the CRL will just be absorbed into the whole system. So really appreciate the positivity and the creativity towards this exciting transformation project that's so nearly there. And maybe we need a name for the whole network. That would be cool. And I loved all the different acronyms that people were coming up with. That was really creative. Thanks for letting me know about it.
That was Auckland Councillor Julie Ferry speaking about Mayor Wayne Brown's controversial comment towards an RNZ staff member, the latest statistics on illegal dumping in New Zealand, and alternative names for the City Rail Link. We'll be right back. You're listening to The Wire on 95BFM.
Have you tried mindfulness? Try mindfulness.
City Counselling on 95BFM.
Yeah, it's a sweet store, great community.
Oi, no dribbling on the vinyl!
Gotta keep the label fiends in line, but they're alright.
Hey, what's the policy? You lick it, you buy it.
Yeah, see you at the counter. Music nerds, am I right?
The Flying Nun Record Store, Karangahape Road, opposite St. Kevin's, stocking a deliciously curated selection of interesting music, label releases, merch and more. Visit Flying Nun Record Store, 202 Karangahape Road, or online at flyingnun.co.nz.
Matt Corby is coming to Aotearoa to bless Auckland's ears with his sweet, sweet melodies. And 95BFM is blessing B-card holders with the chance to win tickets to the show. So keep that dial locked in on 95BFM Breakfast all week for your cue to enter. Live Nation and 95BFM present Matt Corby. The Tragic Magic Tour at the Auckland Town Hall, Friday, May 29th. Tickets and further information at livenation.co.nz.
Decalcify your pineal gland live on broadcast radio. It's a contact lens for your third eye, a pacemaker for your anahata chakra.
Rehabilitate your aura with Aaron on Psychic Glands. Delicate, psychedelic, transcendent, blissful.
Psychic Glands, every Thursday, 11 p.m. to 1 a.m. on 95BFM, and available eternally on podcast and RSS at 95BFM.com.
At this radio station, we do our utmost to abide by the Broadcasting Standards Authority and their rules and guidelines. If you seriously think we've crossed the line on air, give us a call on 309 4831 within 20 working days of the broadcast date and tell us about it. We'll be able to help you out and tell you the procedure if you wish to make a formal complaint to the Broadcasting Standards Authority. Fuck knuckles, cock and piss. Balls. Thank you.
Seagull on a marble stand, trying to find the ocean, looking everywhere. Hard times in the city, in a hard free. Look, I'm the corner.
my little brother Ray.
Is the plague at all a threat in the modern day?
No.
The Wire. Welcome back to The Wire on 95BFM. Green Party MP Kahurangi Carter has put forward a bill to Parliament that would remove any chance of prosecution for someone who needs medical assistance for a drug overdose. The bill has passed through its first reading with support from the Greens, Labour, ACT and Te Pāti Māori. It is now set to go to Select Committee for consultation. To discuss why the bill has come about and what kind of impact it could have on drug safety in Aotearoa, I spoke to Executive Director of the NZ Drug Foundation, Sarah Helm. And so we've seen this new bill being pushed through. Now it's gone through its first reading in Parliament, looking at overdoses and the legal consequences there. Before we, I guess, get into what the bill could do, how frequent are overdoses in New Zealand, and what do people tend to do when they overdose? Do they tend to look for help, or do they tend to try to manage it on their own?
Yeah, so we are losing 3 New Zealanders every single week to unintentional overdose. That's a lot of people. So if you compare it to the road toll, for example, it's about half. Compared to drownings, which is another measure we look at, it equates to twice as many of those. So it's a lot of New Zealanders. That's the fatal overdose versus non-fatal. And look, one of the recurring themes we had from people we talked to, from a survey we did of people who used drugs last year, from coronial cases, is that one of the factors is people are nervous about getting in trouble with the law, and so they hesitate or they fail to call for help, and that contributes to the fatalities and contributes very specifically. Coronial cases have identified that as a factor. So we don't want people to hesitate. We want them to ring without fear and get that help, because we know it will save lives. That's what's in behind this bill.
Yeah, and so what does the bill do? Does it just get rid of entirely that fear of prosecution?
Yeah, I mean, I think we've got a bit of awareness raising to do as well, but what the legislation would do if it goes through, so at the moment it's passed its first reading, it has to go through a select committee process, and that might change what's in the legislation, because that's the whole point of a select committee process, is to for the experts and people who have experienced this to feed into it. But basically it would mean that somebody isn't at risk of being prosecuted for low-level crimes like drug use, drug possession, possession of utensils, or what they call social supply, so to supply to a small number of people, which is often the case in a party or a group drug-taking situation. Somebody's purchased it for that small group. So they wouldn't be at risk of prosecution, which would take away that fear. And we know that it's not just fear of prosecution for the people who are still alert. Often it's also fear for the person who has overdosed. In fact, I just was interviewed by a journalist who was in that situation, and they rang for help. They'd witnessed the situation, and the friends were really scared of calling. So we know this is a real thing, and it will hopefully eliminate that fear, give people the confidence to call, confidence that it's going to be dealt with as a health issue rather than a police issue.
Yeah. In the law, is it affecting all drugs, or is it only sort of the ones that we categorise as being lower harm?
No, all drugs. Yeah, well, so I mean, the harms are different depending on the substance. Some substances are more harmful because they carry more risk of addiction. You don't necessarily have addiction if you've had an overdose. It might be your first time using a substance or first time using any substance. It could be that you took too much, you took too many different things, you had alcohol in your body or a medicine in your body. There can be a whole lot of factors as to what contributes to an overdose. Wasn't the drug you thought it was, etc. And so, no, it's for any substance. So the substances that are leading in terms of overdoses, it's opioids, benzodiazepines, alcohol, those ones often feature. And oftentimes the person has more than one thing in their body if they've experienced a fatal overdose.
And in some of the talk about the bill, National MP Sam Uffendale said that police do already do something similar to this, maybe not necessarily at a broad policy level, but have discretion in these sort of cases. What does the current system look like, and is it at all comparable to what we could see after this bill is passed?
Yes, the discretion is still what leaves people scared, I guess, because they don't know whether the police will decide to charge them or not. And so whilst we have great relationships with police ourselves as an organisation, and many people won't experience this, there's always the risk that they will, and for some people they do. And so it's really about eliminating that uncertainty and that fear.
And the bill's also being criticised in some other cases, with NZ First Minister Casey Costello saying that from her experience it's not the fear of prosecution, but rather maybe people not knowing enough about the drugs or that sort of thing. Do you think that's the case in your experience, and I guess how would you respond to those claims?
Yeah, I draw the line at arguing with MPs or ministers, but in terms of what we know from people who use drugs that they are scared. We surveyed people last year, people who use drugs, 40% of them said that they would be hesitant to call 111. Certainly it is the substances, including alcohol, that contribute to overdose, but that not getting help makes a huge difference. And we can see that to some degree in the statistics we do have. Another thing that I think is really important is students in Victoria University for Salience surveyed a few hundred students last week. Now, not proper science, but what they did find is that 41% of the students who answered knew somebody personally who had overdosed. That tells me we have an issue and we need to make sure that the right supports are in place.
And that, I guess, flows into nicely the last thing I wanted to talk about, which is thinking about future changes as well. While this bill is good, it's obviously not enough to deal with overdosing at the cause level, right? It's more in a response framing. What kinds of policies would you like to see going forward, and would the NZ Drug Foundation like to see going forward to address the issue more broadly?
Yeah, we have some good things in place already. So drug checking, us being able to test people's substances for them, the early warning system, High Alert, that puts out the notifications, those things are really good. We have limited access to a medicine called naloxone, which reverses opioid overdose. We'd like to see more of that. We've also asked for, and the government has promised, to look at a response ever. So if somebody has a non-fatal overdose, it's a big predictor that they'll have a future one. So if you go to hospital at the moment, you just get sent home. The government have promised to put in a support for those people, like a peer, to go and visit them and talk to them about how to prevent overdose in the future. So that's another good one. We'd also love to see what we have over in Australia, Canada, all the other places that do good things, which is a consumption room. So for the people who are very, very at risk of overdose, they're able to, for example, I went to one recently in Sydney, Uniting Church. They've had it since the late 80s. People can go and consume the drug there and be medically supervised to ensure that they don't have an overdose. So there are a range of things we could put in place, but this one is actually a big one. We've been pushing for it for 10 years, so to have some movement on it is pretty important.
That was Executive Director of the New Zealand Drug Foundation, Sarah Helm, talking to me about a bill put forward to Parliament that would remove any chance of prosecution for someone who needs medical assistance for a drug overdose. We'll be right back after the short break. This is Heavenly Body by D. Tyrone.
At all. It's okay.
Welcome back to The Wire on 95BFM. Text in your thoughts at any point on any of these interviews. 5395 is the number. Let us know.
So it's a very odd time to be alive, as they say.
The Wire.
The modern slavery bill has passed its first reading in Parliament with strong cross-party support. The bill would introduce mandatory reporting for large businesses, requiring them to publish annual statements on modern slavery risks in their operations and supply chains. World Vision says the bill is an important step in strengthening New Zealand's response to child labour, human trafficking and exploitation. I spoke with World Vision New Zealand's National Director TJ Grant about what the bill would change, how modern slavery can end up in everyday products, and what happens when next at the Select Committee. I began by asking what the bill aims to address.
Sure. So the Modern Slavery Bill, which was introduced through the first reading to Parliament yesterday, really helps to strengthen New Zealand's response to slavery and exploitation. And so what the bill does is it's going to require businesses with over $100 million in consolidated revenue to submit an annual modern slavery statement, which is going to make them have to look and check their supply chains to see if there's any risks, if there's any cases, if there's any incidents of modern slavery within their global supply chains. And why that's so important is because we know that there is many risks with modern slavery, with global business. No Kiwi or New Zealander wants to be supporting that. And so this law and legislation helps to make sure that businesses are operating fairly. It makes sure that consumers can be buying goods with confidence. And ultimately, it helps to fight against slavery and exploitation, which I'm sure everybody would agree with doesn't belong in our world today.
And when we say modern slavery, what are we actually talking about?
Yeah, so modern slavery is defined as the worst forms of exploitation, forced labor, child labor, sex trafficking, exploitation of people. And the challenge with this is that there's actually more than 50 million people estimated worldwide trapped in modern slavery today, including an estimated 8,000 right here in New Zealand. And this really feeds in the shadows. People are taken advantage of and exploited. And so what this does is it shines a light. It encourages and businesses to make sure that they're making sure that where they're getting their goods from, where they're getting their supplies from, is not participating or perpetuating modern slavery.
The release says the average New Zealander spends around $77 a week on goods likely linked to forced labour or child labour. What kind of products are we talking about here?
Yeah, it's a crazy statistic, isn't it, to imagine that the average Kiwi household spending $77 a week on goods likely connected to modern slavery and child labour. And so that's why this bill is so important, because unfortunately, we're all unwittingly participating in this system. So some of the goods include things like electronic goods, with nearly half of risky goods from mobile phones, laptops, electrical components such as batteries. Fast fashion is still a big contributor to risky imports, including clothes which have been made with forced or child labor. And a new phenomenon is fast furniture. Cheap, mass-produced furniture is also very risky. And I think the challenge is, as an individual consumer, it's really difficult to have visibility or to be able to know if I'm buying goods, is that coming from a safe place? And so what this does is it ensures that businesses are all operating from a fair playing field, and that they're checking their supply chain so that we can be buying things with confidence.
Yeah, and just on that, what would businesses actually have to do under this bill, like practically?
Yeah, so what this means for businesses is that they would have to do mandatory reporting. So they have to prepare and publish an annual modern slavery statement with details on incidents, risk, due diligence, and recommendations. There'd be an online public register with annual reports. and also enhanced support for victims of modern slavery and improved collection. What this does is it also aligns New Zealand with many other countries and jurisdictions where that have already put this legislation in place, Australia, the EU, the UK, et cetera. And really what this is it's not meant initially to be a penalizing mechanism or something that's bad for business. It's actually meant to help improve business and help them improve their practices, make sure they're operating fairly. And actually, many businesses have supported this bill. I mean, what's kind of been amazing is the journey to getting to this point with this first reading, because it's been years in the making.
Do you think this transparency is enough, or is it the first step into stronger enforcement?
It's definitely a really important first step to stronger enforcement, and it's definitely the first step, I think, on a journey which can be strengthened as we go. So what happens now with the first reading is this will go to select committee, and we're going to be advocating and connecting at select committee, as many others are, to ensure that we can put forward the best bill that we can at this point. Then that would go to second reading and hopefully third reading, and what we're hoping for and advocating for, and what we've heard from government and labor, is to have this passed into law before the upcoming election. But I think this is the first step on a journey to really having strong, effective laws in place, and so can be strengthened over time.
This bill also includes support for victims. What would that involve?
So this is a really important aspect, because at the end of the day, it's the victims, it's those that are trapped in modern slavery or forced labor that we're ultimately hoping to address, and that's who World Vision cares about, vulnerable children and families, and why we do this work. And so what the bill would require is a guide to government agencies for support, improved victim identification, and services made available to trafficking survivors.
On a global scale, how does New Zealand compare with this new bill to other countries on modern slavery laws?
So this is really important for New Zealand to get up to speed, to align with other countries that have already put these practices and measures in place. I mentioned the EU, the UK, Canada had recently put in these laws, and Australia has had similar legislation in place already for a number of years. And so many New Zealand companies are already having to report and comply with this legislation in Australia. So this is an important step to bring New Zealand in line with many of these other countries and trading partners in how we do these things. And so that's really important.
And what's one thing you would want listeners to take away from this?
I think the biggest thing is that this legislation, which had overwhelming support from over 80% of the public, overwhelming support from business, 112 MPs, so overwhelming support from across the political spectrum to move this forward, that this legislation, this fighting modern slavery, wouldn't have been possible without everyday Kiwis, supporters of World Vision, and many others advocating to bring it into place. And so that we can make a difference, we can improve children's lives, we can raise the moral floor for our society, and we can help businesses to make business fairer, have a level playing field, and ultimately to fight global challenging complex issues like modern slavery with really tangible strategic things that we can do, like policies like this in New Zealand. And so I think it'd be an encouragement to listeners that we can make a difference, we can have a positive impact in the world, and this is a really important, significant step in combating modern slavery globally and here in New Zealand.
That was World Vision New Zealand's National Director TJ Grant speaking about the first reading of the Modern Slavery Bill.
The Wire.
I don't know, and frankly, the whole thing gives me the heebie-jeebies.
The Wire.
University of Auckland researchers have been recognized by Quanta magazine for one of the major biology breakthroughs of 2025. This study suggests evolution happens in short, intense bursts rather than as a slow, steady process. Researchers looked at examples across cephalopods, ancient enzymes, and Indo-European languages to better understand how changes happen over time. I spoke with Dr. Peter Willis about punctuated equilibrium, the origins of genetic code, and why this research is gaining international attention.
So to start broadly, what was the main finding of your research?
Okay, so this was a kind of a spin-off from a main topic. The main topic is the origin of the genetic code, and this is what I've been studying with Charlie Carter from the University of North Carolina for probably 15 years. And we recently got a big grant from the Sloan Foundation in the US. That's just been renewed for 2 years. But the study that spun off was about what they call punctuated equilibria in evolution. And the idea is that evolution proceeds sort of gradually, just slowly. And then every now and again, there's a big spurt. And that usually happens at speciation events, you know, when some family tree divides. And so Jordan Douglas, who was working with our group as a postdoctoral fellow, he devised a way of testing current data to see whether or not it had evolved through such a kind of procedure. And when he did the rigorous testing, he found that he could distinguish between data which showed that there had been spurts in evolution or spikes, and data when that hadn't occurred. And so when he applied it to a great range of natural sets of data, from the enzymes that we study in the origin of the genetic code, from the origin, let's just say the development of the cephalopods, their evolution, that's octopuses and squids and whatnot, and also Indo-European languages, when he applied it to those sets of data, he found that indeed there was really strong evidence that evolution had proceeded with spurts. And this was the idea that Niles Eldredge and Stephen Jay Gould had in the 1970s, and it always remained controversial. So when they saw our study, Quanta magazine, it's an online magazine, mostly science and maths, published in the US, they nominated our study as one of the biggest breakthroughs in biology in 2025. So, you know, that it's pretty nice when you get that sort of positive reinforcement.
When it came to the study, what inspired you to look at all the different systems of, like, cephalopods versus languages versus enzymes?
Oh, that was Jordan's idea, because he first of all, we did it in order to show, which is what we, I mean, the evolution of the enzymes which operate the genetic code necessarily goes through these sharp transitions when you add another another letter to the amino acid alphabet. And so, of course, we needed this sort of analysis in order to understand the system we were looking at. And so he then decided to go and look at other traditional data sets and found the same thing, and he just chose whatever was available, the things that looked interesting. And the evolution of language is something which has been studied using the BEAST software, as it's called, that was first developed by Alexei Drummond, who's a professor of biology here, and Jordan's been involved. Remco Bukert, who's another member of our team, he's been involved in the development of that software. So they naturally Jordan chose the sets of data which had been used with this software before.
And you mentioned before about how Qantas magazine described this as the biggest biological breakthrough of 2025.
One of them.
Why do you think the research has gained that level of attention?
Because it's related to the controversy that we had for so many years about punctuated equilibria, whether evolution was gradual, the way it's envisaged in the ordinary Darwinian interpretation. You know, mutations accumulate slowly and you get slow, gradual change, and it's been a long, long time, and so then you can explain the evolution of complex biological structures. That's the traditional view. Whereas it does seem that when you get new things happening, it doesn't proceed that way. It happens suddenly in spurts, and that's why you have apparent breaks in the fossil record. You have, you know, long, slow development change or almost no change at all, and then suddenly, boom, you get this big change and you get two different things springing off something which was their common ancestor.
Yeah, does this complicate the theory of how life began?
I don't know about complicates the theory. It describes part of the process of how life began. I mean, we view life as a system which interprets genetic information. And the thing is, you know, if you just had the human genome out in space, it wouldn't mean anything at all. It's got to be embedded in sort of like hardware which can operate software in order to interpret that information. And what life does is it takes the information and it interprets it to produce the hardware that can run the software. I mean, it's a very circular kind of logic of what you have in life. And so from that point of view, looking at these sharp transitions in the development of that interpreter system, that molecular biological interpreter, those sharp transitions are things that we expect to find. And so it sort of does enlighten us about that.
And your research suggests that RNA and peptides maybe have evolved together. Why is that important for your understanding?
Okay, so peptides really are the things that you need to interpret genetic information. These peptides in particular, the enzymes that operate the genetic code. And so we sort of see the origin of life in terms of a kind of serendipitous simultaneous occurrence of things which kind of recognize one another and produce a way of interpreting genetic information, and that as a whole series of transitions in which at each stage when you add something new to the interpreter, it upsets everything that's there. It has to settle down to a new system of interpretation, and that's how it is that the genetic code can start off with something really, really simple which just serendipitously arises and then develop into something more complicated like the 20 amino acid genetic code that we have today.
And from this point in research, what would be your next questions? Is there any more questions that arise from all of these new conclusions?
What we really want to do is refine our picture of how what I've just described can actually happen and go into the detail of the first stages, if we can possibly deduce that from the data which are available in organisms that are alive today. I mean, the point is that every cell has a common ancestor or thereabouts from 4 billion years ago, and already then the genetic code had evolved, and so we all have the same genetic code, we all have the same enzymes, so we can take the enzymes from such diverse organisms that have separated from one another 4 billion years ago and then trace the family history back to those enzymes and then look at the families of those enzymes from before the last universal common ancestor. And so we want to refine our picture of exactly what happened way back then.
And finally, what's one thing you'd like the listeners to take away from this research? What's the significance for us?
I think the significance is that we don't know as much as we really think we know about biology, that there is a hell of a lot more to be found out in terms of how that fine, and I would say intelligent, structure works. That coding structure, I mean, if you're going to talk about computers having intelligence, for God's sake, you should be thinking of organisms as having that kind of thing themselves. I mean, the genetic code is a system whereby molecules sort of learn to recognize one another, learn to manipulate one another so that they can take information and make themselves. I mean, if that's not deserving of the term intelligence, I don't know what is.
That was Dr. Peter Willis speaking on the University of Auckland's breakthrough study on evolution.
That was The Wire.
Era te hōtaka katoa mō tēnei wiki, nei te mihi ki a koutou katoa I kōreo mai ki mātou mō tēnei rā. That's a wrap on The Wire for our party of Thursday. Thank you to everyone who spoke with us today. Labour MP Shannon Halbert, Auckland Councillor Julie Ferry, Executive Director of the NZ Drug Foundation, Sarah Helm, World Vision New Zealand National Director TJ Grant, and Dr. Peter Wills. Nei rā hoki te mihi ki a koutou e whakarongoana. Thanks for tuning in. You're listening to 95BFM. Next up is the 1-4 with Sophia.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.